It's been an active monsoon so far this year with dust, wind, and rain. It's that last one that planners want more detail on. And they're asking for your help to record history.
People say it hasn't flooded for a long time. It flooded last year. In 2013, we had floods in parts of this valley. We've had floods already this year in certain parts of this valley.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, hoping for a flood of photos. Also, early ballots are hitting mailboxes this week. Cue the engine revving sounds for candidates. The ethics of sending doctors into and then pulling them out of infectious disease zones.
Also, this.
There is this glorious moment when Ian Malcolm, played by Jeff Goldblum, removes his shirt for no apparent reason. And he is our number one hunk.
I think we're going to let that one speak for itself.
Yeah, you have to.
Plus, yellow vests in intersections and blue signs on freeways.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley Traffic, I want to update you on a problem that has been in effect since the morning commute. I-17 southbound remains closed at the 303, so avoid that area if you can. There was an earlier rollover and also a fatality. Valley weather for tonight, we're looking for partly cloudy skies, a 20% chance for rain and lows near 80. Then for this weekend, chance of rain both Saturday and Sunday, a high of 101 tomorrow, and then 98 on Sunday. It's currently cloudy and 96 degrees.
An ASU professor who accused campus police of excessive force when they arrested her has been sentenced to 9 months of supervised probation. A Maricopa County Superior Court administrator in Mesa sentenced Ursula Orr this morning. Last month, Orr pleaded guilty to one misdemeanor count of resisting arrest under a plea deal. Under that agreement, prosecutors dismissed a felony count of aggravated assault and two other charges. University police say Orr was stopped May 20th for walking in the middle of a street near campus and refused to show identification. They say she kicked an officer in the shin after being handcuffed.
A bill designed to overhaul the Veterans Affairs healthcare system passed the Senate Thursday afternoon on a 91-3 vote. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, the final step for the legislation is a presidential signature.
The VA bill easily passed both the House and Senate this week with strong bipartisan support. Dr. Sam Foote is one of the initial VA employees to blow the whistle on alleged mismanagement. He says the bill is a good first step, but adds there are some problems money can't fix.
Sometimes money helps, but in the case of Phoenix, where so many experienced people who have gotten frustrated and left, throwing money at that problem is not going to solve it easily.
The eight lawmakers who voted against it say they were concerned with how much the $16 billion legislation would grow the national budget deficit. President Obama is expected to sign the measure into law. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
One of the leading forces behind the VA legislation, both behind the scenes and in front of the cameras, has been Arizona Senator John McCain. Arizona Republic National political reporter Dan Nowicki says McCain's influence was considerable.
Just a few weeks ago, you know, this wasn't even on the radar screen for Congress. Congress obviously has a well-deserved reputation for dysfunction. But this is an example where it was viewed as an emergency, as a nonpartisan or a bipartisan issue, and both chambers actually worked together to come up with a solution. Sarah McCain, as you mentioned, was very involved with it. He's actually not on the VA committee, but the Senate Republicans, I think, partially because he's such a high-profile senator, and he's the type of guy they lean on when heavy lifting is required.
In Arizona, we talk about illegal immigration a lot. And the two senators that we have, Senators McCain and Flake, were heavily involved, obviously, in the Gang of Eight, writing that together, the bipartisan group. Didn't go anywhere in the House. Have they expressed any frustration about that?
Well, I think they have been frustrated. They did try to lobby the House. And on the year anniversary of the bill, I asked them, you know, was there anything you could have done differently? And they didn't think there really was. It's, you know, you kind of have to let the House work its will, as they say on the Hill. You know, the Senate can only do so much. I think now they've kind of turned to this immediate border crisis, the humanitarian situation. And you see a lot of politics erupting on the Hill this week on this issue. And one of them is, I mean, Harry Reid even mentioned that, you know, he obviously doesn't like the approach the House GOP is taking on this. And he said, like, well, if the House passes their bill, you know, maybe we can attach our Senate Gang of Eight bill. Now, you know, the majority leader knows that that's just gonna, you know, inflame the House conservatives. The Gang of Eight Republicans, including McCain and Flake, have had to put out two statements in the past week or so, basically saying, that's not going to happen. We're not going to attach our bill to a border crisis legislation that comes out of the House. There's a lot of gamesmanship. The House is taking up DACA, the Deferred Action Program of the president. That's kind of a sop or a giveaway to the conservative wing of the caucus mm-hmm. that's been opposed to a lot of what the House leadership has been trying to do on immigration. So DACA doesn't really have anything to do with the border crisis. Some conservatives blame it. There's not really been any hard evidence that's tied, you know, that the president's program to the influx of children.
Is there anyone else in the Arizona delegation in the House, Matt Salmon perhaps, who has been really outspoken on this issue?
Yeah, right. Matt Salmon is he's the chairman of the Western Hemisphere Subcommittee in the House, and he was tapped by the House Speaker John Boehner to serve on his special ad hoc working group to find a solution with the border crisis. And Salmon actually traveled down to Central America a couple of weeks ago. He really is in the thick of it. He's a major player on this particular issue, and I know he's been working on the House Republican response.
Dan Nowicki, national political reporter for the Arizona Republic.
The West African country of Sierra Leone has declared a state of emergency to tackle the deadly Ebola outbreak. The country's authorities say areas where the disease is reported will be quarantined, and this will be enforced by the military. Tough emergency measures are also being put in place in Liberia, and several other African countries have announced measures to screen travelers at their borders. The BBC's Tulip Mazumder has been to Guinea, where the outbreak was first reported back in March of this year.
We're just a few kilometers away now from where this virus first emerged from the forest, this outbreak. It's this area of the country where the virus made that jump from animals thought to be fruit bats into the human population here and then spread to neighbouring Liberia and Sierra Leone, which is just a few miles from where we're driving now. Ebola is believed to have killed more than 200 people in Gekedu alone.
You just have to, you know, spray your shoes here and then wash your hands with water and chlorine here.
Many of them have been treated at this Ebola center, run by medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières. We have to wear protective overalls to get inside. As we arrive, we see the latest victim, a four-month-old baby boy. His name was Fire, and he caught Ebola from his mother, who also died from the virus. Adele Milimono from MSF looked after Fire in the moments before his death.
I was there with him just before he died. I had been feeding him milk. I stepped away just for a short break, but then I was called back and he was dead. I was totally devastated. At times, I just go outside and cry.
J'ai pleuré même, c'était très difficile pour moi de supporter.
Red Cross workers wearing protective green gowns and rubber gloves dig a hole in the ground just around the corner from the treatment centre. They have disinfected Fire's body and wrapped it in white plastic sheets. Carefully, they lower the tiny bundle into the ground. Fire's family were too scared to attend the burial, so he's laid to rest by strangers. His is an anonymous grave, along with the 19 other Ebola victims who were buried here. In remote villages devastated by Ebola, the fear is palpable. And that fear is helping spread the virus.
We are here now at Kolubengu village, some 20 minutes from east of Gekedu.
Tarek Yasarevich is from the World Health Organization. Members of his team were recently attacked when they tried to get in here to investigate a number of deaths. Today, though, residents have agreed to allow them in.
Looking around here, people sat on wooden benches. There's probably around 70 people that have gathered. And this even just a week ago, just wasn't possible, was it?
Exactly. When the first teams were coming to the village, maybe the messages that were sent out were not clear enough. People heard that there is no vaccine and there is no treatment for Ebola. So many thought that why we would then go to some treatment center, and people who did go, eventually some of them died, so there was the perception that if you are taken from your village, it means a certain death. So we did not put maybe enough of emphasis on the fact that there are many survivors, and that sooner you go to the treatment center, better chances you have of survival.
To help reinforce that message, Ebola survivor Sasa Bass tells the community how he got early treatment and recovered. Whilst there's no cure for Ebola, people stand a better chance if they get supportive treatments like rehydration to fight the virus off themselves.
When I was sick, it's very, very difficult to me to eat and to sit down, to wake up. But now I work myself, I run, I greet my children and so on. So I'm very, very happy. I'm very strong.
Good. Oh, yeah. I'm glad to hear that. Okay. You look strong.
After hearing from Sasa Bass and community leaders who are now supporting health workers, two families brought out their very sick relatives. Health workers also found dozens more residents who'd had contact with people who'd died of Ebola. They will now have to be monitored every day for the three-week incubation period to check they don't develop the illness. It's a mammoth task. Local Ministry of Health officials in Gekidu optimistically tell me the outbreak could be over within a couple of months. And it's true that cases here have come down significantly since the start of the crisis. But with deaths increasing at an alarming rate in neighbouring Sierra Leone and Liberia, health charities on the ground say this is more likely to rage on until the end of the year.
That's the BBC's global health reporter, Tulip Mazumder.
A couple of health workers who contracted the Ebola virus have returned to the U.S. for treatment. That's led to concerns about whether residents in this country are safe from an outbreak, while medical professionals have to balance caring for patients with the need to protect themselves and their families. Dr. David Beta is chair of the Bioethics Department at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Tucson. David, you've been in clinics in several countries in the effort to limit the spread of disease. Have you faced a situation where you and your team couldn't stop an illness?
Over the course of several weeks, there was a huge measles epidemic within the refugee camp of 150,000 people. And I had to deal with that, and I lost about 250 children in about 2 weeks. And it was quite traumatic for everybody. As a young child, I grew up overseas, so I never had measles, and I did contact measles and developed measles encephalitis. It is extremely difficult to separate yourself from being responsible for the care and the health of those who have entrusted their health to you, and remembering that you have loved ones back at home that you don't want to compromise by compromising yourself.
Once it happens, is there any feeling that we're putting people in a position where maybe we shouldn't, or maybe they shouldn't be making that choice? Is there a certain danger we're not quite thinking about enough because the mission is such an important one?
It's an excellent question, and let me just answer that by sharing that each one of us in the healthcare profession struggles with the ethical issue of duty to others, our obligation for duty to others, and our obligation to duty to self, and that is protecting ourselves and protecting our loved ones. So it is an extremely difficult decision to make when we are put in a position of being asked to go to an environment that's extremely dangerous, knowing that we may be compromising ourselves and our loved ones, for example. I mean, we can go right back to the United States. Well, let's take, for example, the H1N1 virus influenza epidemic in the States that was moving rapidly through different states. Many, many healthcare professionals were extremely uncomfortable going into the hospital and treating patients because they were afraid they were going to get it and then turn around and pass it on to their loved ones. So we are faced with that dilemma almost on a daily basis, even in a hospital with any contagious patient. And each of us has to soul search and has to come up with what we believe is in everybody's best interest. Can we pass judgment on others? The answer to that is no, and the ethical and the moral groundwork and framework for that is one needs to really be cautious in forcing individuals into situations that may not be in their best interest.
With word that health workers who've contracted Ebola are being brought to the U.S., does it make sense to you that some Americans are very concerned about that and the possible spreading of the illness here?
They have a right to be concerned, but there's also a need to be understanding that with proper precautions put in place and with a concerted effort to protect the population, we have a duty to do our best to help them. When we look at bringing those who have been infected with Ebola to the United States, it's extremely important for us to understand that we have an obligation to serve those, but also an obligation to protect others. And that's where that dilemma comes in. And as long as we are conscious of that and we do our utmost, then passing judgment is a difficult thing for people to do. And so I would ask that those who are concerned about it pose the question, if this was your loved one overseas who had Ebola, would you not want them to come back and be cared for?
For a situation like this, does the U.S. have effective policies in place to keep citizens safe and healthy?
I would have to say yes. There's a small possibility that things can get out of control. But I think with the precautions that are being taken, I truly believe that we are going to be okay. I will, though, emphasize that this is an extremely serious illness and disease and an issue that we all have to be conscious of. But at this point, there's no reason to panic. I think that there's a lot of good intent and good policy and procedure that's in place to protect citizens of the United States.
Dr. David Beda is chair of the Bioethics Department at the University of Arizona College of Medicine.
Still to come, with public funding for public universities on the decline, schools have to look elsewhere for money, and that sometimes means being careful about who you tick off.
I think that universities are supposed to be sources of ideas and sometimes unpopular ideas. So if you are always watching your P's and Q's, you aren't going to be up front very often with critiques.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. With Mark, I'm Steve in Valley Traffic. Not much going on except in a major lingering crash from much earlier this morning, about 6 o'clock. I-17 southbound is still closed at the 303. That's because of an overturned truck, and it's also caused a fatality. So avoid that area if you can. I-17 southbound near the 303. Valley weather for tonight, partly cloudy skies in the forecast with a slight chance for rain and overnight lows around 80. And then for this weekend, it's going to be sticky and cloudy. Look for a high of 101 tomorrow, 98 degrees Sunday. Currently, it's partly cloudy and 96 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Moores & Cabot Investments, a national wealth management firm, serving investors for over 120 years with offices in Phoenix, Scottsdale, and now in Mesa with Deanne Griebel, Senior Vice President of Investments.
Early ballots for August primary election are on the way to about a million Arizona voters. As more of the state's residents choose to vote at the kitchen table instead of a school or church in the neighborhood, campaign strategies have been forced to change. Stacey Pearson is a strategist from the UP agency.
Well, you look at 2010 or even 2012, it would have been unheard of to have a $500,000 advertising buy in May, trying to raise name ID, trying to get some good mojo going into the summer season. And we saw that this cycle. It's changed how buying has occurred, how political events have occurred, how door-to-door campaigns have occurred, how volunteers have been recruited. Everything has bumped up, you know, at least by 3 weeks, in most cases 4, 5, 6 weeks, or even 4 months.
Well, is there a risk, though, knowing you've got to get out there, you've got to get your message out, but can you alienate some of those sort of fringy voters who think, I don't want to hear about this so early?
I think the risk is whether or not your fundraising is going to continue at a pace you expect it to. So certainly there's been a lot of jockeying in, let's say, the Republican gubernatorial primary. So how money comes in and at what pace it comes in is the biggest risk. So if you overspend in May, you've got a problem in August.
But if you've got the money and you've raised it, you don't want to waste that too early, but how late is too late?
July is the most critical point for this. When early ballots dropped or when they were mailed yesterday, you're looking at 75% of Republicans who voted in 2012 voted with that mail, with that ballot they're getting in the mail. So July is critically important. It's a matter of finding people who are in town and making sure the money's being spent wisely to reach your voter that's going to return their ballot.
Who are the folks who are not voting early, and how do campaigns decide to strategize around them? Because you still don't want to miss out on that 40% who haven't voted yet.
You look at precinct by precinct. It's funny, this election game has gone from more of a shotgun to an absolute sniper. So you can literally see whether or not someone who's received an early ballot has returned it. And you can stalk them as much as you'd like to get your guy to return his ballot or your woman to return her ballot. Conversely, you can look at the precincts that do still have the highest volume of foot traffic and address those neighborhoods very specifically with messages that directly cater to what they're looking at.
Has the new science of this actually made campaigns better?
Certainly, the level of sophistication has increased in our ability to track vote by vote. You can send someone to the door of a female voter in a precinct you need to flip blue and go knock and ask her why she hasn't turned in her ballot. It's that specific. It's kind of frightening, but it's that specific. But it makes everybody more effective. So what this looks like long term, I think, is something that we're all interested in seeing. But it's not accidental that we're seeing some really sophisticated attacks this week.
Stacy Pearson of the Scottsdale-based UP Agency. Political scientist Pat Kenny, dean of ASU's College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, says a lot of voters are attracted to the ease of early balloting.
This is going on across many, many states in the country. We just kind of look at evidence called just generally this idea of more convenience voting. So early balloting, mail-in balloting, those kinds of processes make it much easier for people to participate over a longer period of time. So it really lowers the actual time costs of voting. And some of the evidence does show that there's a little increase in turnout due to that. For certain, there's a little bit better participation among stronger partisans because they have a number of opportunities and time frame to get that in there.
Pat, what do we know about the voters who have not yet gone to early balloting? I can say for my mom, she's someone who really likes to go to the polls. Are there certain people that probably are just not going to be swung to early voting?
Yeah, for sure. I think there's this, I'm like your mother. I actually like to go on election day and actually just kind of involve myself in the ritual of voting. I don't even mind if there's a bit of a line because people are talking about politics. And I rather like that, and I think there are a number of people that do as well. But there's no question that the complexity of people's lives, day-to-day lives, and all the things they're trying to accomplish between work and family and their health and all those kinds of things, it's just easier for them to have multiple opportunities across a longer time frame.
Do we expect that early balloting number to keep climbing? And is there a certain maximum you think it will reach? I mean, we'll never reach 100, certainly, but how close do you think we'll get?
Right. So among the early voters, you mean?
Exactly.
Yeah. So I just was there's just a little evidence about that, and there's a little debate about that. One, there's some evidence that shows they become habitual with that, so they get used to it, and so the percentage rises to a certain level, so let's say 2/3-ish, and then kind of plateaus right there. There's another one said that voters try it early on and then are as easily distracted as the people who go to the booth by life's complications after kind of an initial interest in trying it.
ASU political scientist Pat Kenny.
When states cut back on funding for public universities, as many have, where do those schools turn for money? An article in the LA Times this week suggested some universities are, quote, selling their souls, and referenced ASU in a job posting for that school looking for applicants specializing, quote, in the history of capitalism and political economy, which includes a grant from the Koch brothers. Bob Zemsky is a longtime faculty member at Penn and the chair and CEO of the Learning Alliance for Higher Education there. He says public universities are having to look more and more for private donors.
I once wrote an essay about what happened to the public and public higher education. And it, you know, if you send the funding out elsewhere, you're going to get a different kind of system, and that's what's going on.
So what are some of the issues that come along with universities having to look for money elsewhere?
Well, they become less insular. So Some people, I would suspect, think that's a good idea, but you are less reflective because you need to watch your P's and Q's every minute of the day. And that's different than being censored. But, you know, if you're raising money from philanthropists like the Koch brothers and things like that, you don't want your president out saying something that irritates them or irritates other people. So you get presidents who are less likely to be public spokesmen for higher education.
Is that a bad thing?
It's different. That's a kind of opinion question. So I think it's a bad thing because I think that universities are supposed to be sources of ideas and sometimes unpopular ideas. So if you are always watching your P's and Q's, you aren't going to be up front very often with critiques.
I would imagine that it's a different kind of thing to lobby the state legislature or the governor or write grants to, you know, these big sort of foundations. Is it a different kind of operation to try to solicit money from a private philanthropist as opposed to a grant or a public institution?
Well, it's interesting you threw foundations into the mix. The big foundations that support higher education are now smaller in number, and they act just the same way that the Koch brothers asked. They have their agendas, and if you want their money, you better do their agenda. Once upon a time, foundations were sort of sources of venture capital for universities. That's not true anymore. They all believe in advocacy philanthropy, they say.
Do you imagine this is a trend that's going to continue, or do you think at some point it will go back to sort of where it was in the past?
It's hard to say about what we're going to do with the price structure for most of higher education. If the states continue to reduce their contribution, and there's some fundamental change in the federal way that student aid works, then we're going to see an acceleration of this trend. If states step up again to funding higher education, funding academies rather than sort of enterprises, then there could be some reversal. But we're beyond the tipping point. We're in a different place now, and it's pretty hard to go back to where we were.
Bob Zemsky is the chair and CEO of the Learning Alliance for Higher Education at the University of Pennsylvania.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Patrick Gilbury, and I'm helping people fix their bikes. Bike Saviors is a tool share and bike collective. Someone comes in, I show them how to use the tools, where the tools are, where the parts are. I don't ever actually work on anyone's bike. I just teach them how to do it themselves. I think that it's really important for people to understand how their bikes work and how everything works in their lives and just have a better sense of how to fix things. I like bikes because and they're fun to ride and they're good for the environment, good for people. Even on a really hot day, it's more pleasant to be outside than driving around in a car.
That's Patrick Gilbury at Bike Saviors in Tempe. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to tell us about your 10-speed, send us a note, the show at kjazz.org. Checking Valley traffic at this hour on the show with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. I-17 southbound, still a major problem because of an earlier crash. 17 southbound remains closed at the 303.
The night skies over Glendale will be including more planes from Luke Air Force Base this month. Luke officials say F-16 student pilots from several squadrons will be flying on weeknights until 11:30. The flights will not involve any F-35 fighter jets and will not take place on the weekends. The additional night flying will take place throughout August. Base officials say nighttime training is an integral part of students' training. The base is allowed to fly 24 hours a day, but officials say they try to limit late-night flights to reduce the impact on surrounding communities.
Winds from a rainstorm knocked over 10 trailers in the Buckeye area, as two people suffered minor injuries. Some residents of the affected trailer park took refuge in a nearby Walmart store after they lost power as a result of last night's storm. Buckeye Fire Chief Bob Costello says firefighters had to extricate several people from the overturned trailers. One of them says he and his wife had just gone to bed when the storm hit, shaking their trailer. It then flipped over, trapping them inside.
Crews are still cleaning up from last weekend's macro burst in North Phoenix. The city's deputy public works director, Felipe Moreno, says his department tries to be judicious about using its overtime budget so it can respond to storms like that one. He says this year's monsoon and last weekend's storm have been big.
This one did have heavy damage. There were block walls blown down, large trees that were blowing into major streets. Parks were upended in a lot of ways with trees. I know there were 9 city parks affected with 54 trees lost. We've collected 93 tons of debris so far.
Moreno says he doesn't have an estimate yet on what this year's monsoon has cost. He predicts another week or so of cleanup from the macro burst. But monsoons also bring rain, and in some cases, lots of it. This can cause flooding, as can winter storms.
The Flood Control District of Maricopa County wants to hear from you and see your photos of flooding. It's sending out postcards to residents, inviting them to take part in a survey and upload pictures and videos of flooding in their neighborhood. Bill Wiley is the chief engineer and general manager of the Flood Control District of Maricopa County.
It's always helpful to have the public report what's going on because we can't have people there all the time in every place, and we just don't have that many staff.
Wiley says any information is valuable, and not just for his department's scientists and engineers.
People say it hasn't flooded for a long time. It flooded last year. In 2013, we had floods in parts of this valley. We've had floods already this year in certain parts of this valley. So if it doesn't affect you, you don't think it happens. So we forget very quickly.
Another aspect of the public outreach is getting information for upcoming studies. Teresa Pinto is a project manager for a 95-square-mile study area in northeast Maricopa County.
Some of these floodplains were delineated. They were mapped over 20 years ago. There's been a lot of changes over the last 20 years. Some of these changes have the potential to affect flood water, where the water goes, how deep, and how fast the water is moving. So we want to update the flood hazards, identify those flood hazards, and identify where those flood hazards are causing problems for people.
What kind of changes have been happening in that part of town that affect the way that water could potentially flood?
Basically, the major development that's been occurring over the last 20 years, especially in this part of the valley.
So what are you hoping to find out from people who live in this area?
One of the reasons we sent out the postcard was, one, to introduce them to the project, let them know we're having public meetings in September. But also, we have a couple online tools that we'd like people to start using. One of them is that risk tolerance survey. And the reason that we wanted to do that is to help us know what the public thinks should be fixed as far as flooding problems. The bottom line is that we only have a limited number of dollars to work with, taxpayer dollars. So we want to be conscientious about where we prioritize and focus spending those dollars and what the public thinks we should be fixing. The Report a Flood tool is a very valuable tool, especially for us here at the Flood Control District. But I also think for people who have lived in the desert for so many years, I think a lot of people get excited when it rains, and they love taking pictures of things that don't happen that often. So it's an easy way for us to collect georeference photos and videos and then also display them.
Teresa Pinto is a project manager with the Flood Control District of Maricopa County.
Thousands of Valley kids are going back to school soon, and the people who help them cross the street safely are brushing up on their skills. As KJZZ's Steve Shadley reports, local crossing guards have been attending training seminars, and they're ready to go.
This busy stretch of road near Jefferson Elementary School in Mesa is just one of many locations where a crossing guard will be working. Cars and trucks zoom by in the school zone, but in a few days when classes start, people are going to have to slow down.
They've kind of forgotten over the summer that the children are out there and to look for them, because they don't always look for you.
Margaret Boone is with the Maricopa Association of Governments, which organized the crossing guard training sessions. In Mesa this week, about 100 crosswalk workers are watching a video.
Teach the children the proper way to cross the street by doing it the right way yourself. Stop before entering the street, look left, then right, then left again, waiting for a safe gap in traffic.
A lot of these guards are retirees, concerned parents, or simply people who want a part-time job. 74-year-old Norman Rancourt has been working crosswalks at Sarine School in Chandler for almost a decade. He says it's a family affair.
I work with my wife. We both do it. I see the kids every day, and it's something I love to do. I'm not going to retire. They're going to have to carry me out.
Rancourt says these training sessions keep him at the top of his game. He's been off work all summer, and he's getting a refresher course on how to dress for the job, including reflective vests and floppy hats, and more about traffic laws, like no walking kids across the street when a vehicle's tires are in the crosswalk, plus proper placement of school zone road signs. Did you know there's also a right and wrong way crossing guards are supposed to use those handheld stop sign paddles? Melissa Kent says it's not as easy as it looks.
The only time that I really have problems is when it's really windy. The sign feels like it's going to take me away with the wind, but so sometimes I have to use both hands, but not a problem.
Kent has been a guard at Chrisman Elementary School in Mesa for about a year. She says crosswalk workers put their life on the line.
There was a lady that was probably going more than 45 miles an hour through a school zone and actually caught air going over a bump in the street and then didn't even stop at the corner that was 50 feet away and went around the corner on two wheels, and I was just in amazement.
Speeding, unsafe passing, not stopping for the kids, not stopping for the adults in the area.
Mikey Barra has been a Mesa cop for two decades, and he's seen all kinds of dumb moves by drivers in school zones. He says the most common mistake happens when people are in a hurry.
If there's already a car in the school zone doing a certain speed, you can't pass that car even to acquire 15 miles an hour. Once you pass it, that's an illegal movement.
And that can be expensive. In Arizona, speeding violations in school zones are doubled, and in Mesa, it could cost you up to $500. Brandon Forey is a transportation planning engineer with the city of Peoria.
The fines are by far the highest in the city of Peoria. They exceed $680. So if there's one place in the valley you don't want to get caught for a fine in a school zone, it's Peoria.
Valley police officers will be out in big numbers looking for violations during the first few weeks of the new school year. Mesa's police department even got a state grant to pay officers who work extra hours monitoring school zones. Steve Shadley, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
I hand over my debit card and dip my face into the top of the to-go bag to inhale the warm garlic naan wrapped loosely in tinfoil. "Where's the baby?" Rajrani asks. She runs our favorite Indian restaurant, and if my son isn't with me, she always asks, "Where's the baby?"
School starts next week for many districts, and kids grow up fast. Here's commentator Karina Bland.
We have been coming here since Sawyer was a baby, but now he's 15, 5'11 and a half, often mistaken for 17, has a voice as deep as Barry White's, and is shaving twice a week. Rajrani is the only one who calls him baby anymore. When you're a new parent, people warn you about how fast children grow up, and it's true. But what they fail to tell you is how dramatic the changes are from one stage to the next. It is like the child they used to be has gone missing. I can go years without seeing my cousins in New Zealand, and we don't change much, not in looks or manner. We're basically still the same people. Where's the baby? I don't know. I mean, the baby I fell in love with, brought home from the hospital and got to know so well, has been gone for a long time. In his place was a familiar and just as lovable toddler who clutched Thomas the Tank Engine rail cars in each hand and had his own ideas about vegetables and bedtime. Then one day the toddler was gone too, replaced by a small boy in a Buzz Lightyear costume who inserted "To infinity and beyond" at the end of the Pledge of Allegiance in place of "And justice for all." Then another boy, one even taller and with huge feet, took up residency in the bedroom, shoved the stuffed animals behind the bed, and emptied his pockets of rocks and Lego minifigures in favor of a cell phone. And then, just when I got used to him, the latest version of this boy turned up this summer, responsible, suddenly knowledgeable about neurobiology and plumbing, and savvy enough to navigate public transportation. The teenage Sawyer is smart, kind, and funny. I like his growing independence. I like watching him discover new interests and hearing his thoughts on current events and politics. It makes for much more interesting dinner conversation than when he was 8 and on a run of knock-knock jokes. But I can't read him as well as I could when he was younger to know what he needed or what he was feeling. I'm not sure he always knows either. Come here. Go away. I've got this. Help me. I love you. I hate you. sometimes at the same time. Sawyer used to plop his foot in my lap, the universal sign for tie my shoe. Now what he drops in my lap are questions about girls, rational numbers, college, whether there is any scientific research supporting his 10 p.m. bedtime, and how people could have stood by and let the Holocaust happen. I don't have all the answers anymore. The 1,600-piece Lego Star Wars Sandcrawler set seems easy now. Soon enough, Sawyer will be driving. For now, I'm still dropping him off at school, a routine I think I will actually miss. He grabs his backpack out of the back of the car, mumbles, "Bye, Mom, love you," and is gone. He doesn't ever look back. I'll try not to either.
Karina Bland writes the column My So-Called Midlife for the Arizona Republic.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody in Valley Traffic. Things are moving well, except for one stretch. I-17 southbound remains closed because of an earlier crash at the 303. Valley weather for tonight, partly cloudy, chance of a dust storm. There's a 20% chance for rain. Look for lows to be near 80. Chance of rain this weekend as well, with highs of 101 and 98 on Saturday and Sunday. It's currently 96 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Montessori Day Schools, an A-graded charter district with private preschools and charter K-8 in Phoenix and Chandler. Details at MontessoriDayschools.org.
With early voting underway, candidates are looking for every vote they can get, and a group that studies turnout among young voters says 18 to 29-year-olds could play a significant role in two Arizona congressional districts. Peter Levine is the director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University in Boston. He says younger voters could play a big role in the 9th district in Tempe, Central Phoenix, and West Mesa, and the 1st district in northern and eastern Arizona.
It's not college students, I think, so much in the first. It's a rural district. It has the highest Native American population, I think, in the United States. But, of course, the young people aren't just college students. So there's a lot of young non-college students in the first, as well as some college students. And they voted at a pretty good rate in the past, and it is a competitive election.
Do you think that young people could make the difference one way or the other in either of these two races in Arizona?
Yes. I mean, essentially, that's why we picked the four races that we picked. They're all races where there's enough young people. The turnout has been good enough, and the margin has traditionally been, or is likely to be, small enough that young people will definitely make the difference.
So where are the other two?
Iowa and New York's 23rd, Western New York.
So that's really saying something, that you guys only picked four races really to watch, and two of them are in Arizona.
Yeah. No, I think it's kind of exciting for Arizona. It's also a sad commentary in the United States that so few congressional races are, in a sense, be decided by any demographic group, because they're basically already decided, because they're so one-sided.
So I looked at one of the other maps that you have on your website, and it showed that in 2010, Arizona actually did pretty well as far as young turnout, 18 to 29-year-old turnout in the midterm election. It was about a little more than 30%, which is, you know, not fantastic, but compared to other states, actually pretty good.
Yeah, I think the national turnout was only about 25% for young people, so that is pretty good. And it's interesting. And I'm not sure I have a complete explanation. I think some competitiveness helps.
So I think this whole discussion has to be sort of tempered with what is probably for you the million-dollar question, which is, how do you actually get young people to vote? Because sort of notoriously, in large numbers, they don't.
Yeah. No, that's sort of my life question. And there's not a simple answer. But one thing is just asking them. So directly asking people, whether by phone or face-to-face, really makes a difference. Young people don't get asked much. Nobody talks to them about politics. They tend to get left off lists for contact. So what we always tell candidates of either party when they ask us for advice is actually just ask young people.
What do you think is a realistic turnout goal for young people?
I'm afraid to say that I think it's probably something like 35 or 40% in an off-year election, in a midterm election. That is, that proportion of all the young citizens in the district voting would be high, but manageable.
Peter Levine is the director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University in Boston. You may have noticed some new signs along Valley freeways, and maybe they're making you hungry. If that's the case, Wynn Holden will be pretty happy. He's the publisher of Arizona Highways Magazine and the CEO of Grand Canyon State Logo Signs, which is in charge of the blue signs near freeway exits that tell drivers where they can eat and gas up, among other services. He says the program has been in rural parts of the state for almost 30 years.
The program has actually been around for almost 30 years in the rural areas of the state, and the ADOT decided it would make sense to take it over and expand it because the revenue going into the highway fund has been declining. So the first job for us was to look at the expansion into the metropolitan areas, with Phoenix first, to be followed by Tucson eventually. So within about 3 years, maybe four, the whole state will be fully signed. And the whole idea is to provide information for motorists on services that they may need exactly when they need them.
So how is it decided which businesses are going to end up on these signs? I assume that there's a pay-to-play kind of thing here.
Absolutely. This is an advertising medium, no question about it. It's about the most cost-effective, cheapest advertising medium for any business. And there are two means. One is that we send out information about the program to qualified businesses at each interchange we're doing, and those businesses have an opportunity to indicate, yep, they'd like to participate. Those are straight rate card, if you will, kind of advertising-based or advertising rate-based programs. The second is if there are a plethora of businesses at the exit, we will do a sealed bid program.
So how much are we talking here? If I'm a business owner at one of these intersections and I'm interested in getting my name and logo up on these signs, how much am I going to have to shell out?
The average for the rural program is about $3,000 a year. And in the urban areas, it's a little bit higher at about $3,250. Now, if it's a bid interchange, it could be substantially higher.
So looking at some of the signs, it looks like a lot of the restaurants especially are fast food places or national chains. Do you get any sort of mom and pop or locally owned independent type restaurants that want to put their logos up there?
Sure. The issue really is count. I mean, there are far more of the national chains that tend to cluster adjacent to major intersections. But Luke's is a restaurant that's down in the Ahwatukee area off I-10. They have a sign. So anybody is eligible to participate. There's no favoritism that goes toward national chains. It's just typically there are more of them.
How much money has the rural program raised for the state so far?
About $1.5 million annually is what the program returns in the rural areas to the state highway fund. And it's important to note that by statute, all the net proceeds from this program are directed into that fund. In the urban areas, we're upside down right now because of the substantial investment that's required. Unlike rural, where everything was in place, it was like buying an existing business. In the urban areas, all the infrastructure has to be put in. So you got to install the posts, you got to do all that work. It's very time consuming and expensive work. So we'll look at maturity in 3 or 4 years. We expect an annual return of a minimum of $5 million annually into the highway fund.
Is there a scenario under which the amount of money that these signs bring in will pay for all the things that the highway trust fund needs to pay for?
I can't imagine that would be the case, because when you look at the five-year plan in the state of Arizona, billions of dollars, certainly $5 to $10 million over time every year is not insignificant, but it certainly doesn't have this program won't have the wherewithal to take care of all of our programs. It's hoped that this new source of revenue will simply lead the state to investigate other potential new sources of revenue, which could help solve the highway fund dilemma.
Wynn Holden is the publisher of Arizona Highways Magazine and the CEO of Grand Canyon State Logo Signs. He says the plan is to be done putting up signs in the valley in 3 years and to be finished statewide within 5 years.
There are a dozen rose test gardens throughout the U.S., and one of them is located right here in the valley. Just what is a rose test garden? KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez tells us.
The northern entrance of Mesa Community College is adorned with rose bushes, thousands of them. They vary in color, varieties, and sizes. Did you know the Mesa Community College Rose Garden is the only rose testing site in the desert southwest?
Every year we get about 80 rose bushes, and then we're testing for 2 years. So those that are in here this year, in 2016, we'll come out and we'll put a whole new group in.
Leroy Brady is with the Mesa East Valley Rose Society and the landscape architect of the garden. He also evaluates the test roses.
There will be everything from hybrid tea to floribunda to grandiflora to shrub roses and climbers.
Brady says in 1996, Mesa Community College approached the Mesa East Valley Rose Society with the idea of a rose garden to spruce up the place. By the following year, the first rose bed was planted along Southern Avenue. In 1999, MCC Garden was granted a test site designation. Today, the garden is among 12 American Rose Society testing sites. The garden is considered unique because the Sonoran Desert has two blooming cycles, unlike any other place in the U.S. The first cycle is between April and June, the second, October through December.
Roses are absolutely beautiful here, and when you think that Arizona grows about 65% of the roses that are sold across the nation, why shouldn't roses be here?
Brady is one of hundreds of volunteers who have planted and cared for the roses since the garden was first created. Public funding helps maintain it. There are more than 350 varieties and about 10,000 rose bushes. On the west end of the campus, rose bushes are planted to form shapes that symbolize the meaning of roses, including one area shaped like a heart and another with a peace symbol design. On the east end of the college campus is a veterans garden, which has 2,000 rose bushes.
And all the roses in the veterans garden have patriotic names or military names, and it's designed around significant things in the military, including the flags of the all five services.
This has become a sightseeing destination for many visitors. Brady and his fellow Rosarians provide tours of the garden, and in the winter, they also offer classes on how to plant and care for the flower. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you know things that we ought to know, tell us. The show at KJZZ.org.
Let's face it, most of us haven't outgrown our childhood fascination with dinosaurs, whether it's watching Jurassic Park for the 27th time or wondering just how King Kong could possibly summon the strength to save Fay Wray from that giant T-Rex.
If you're feeling nostalgic as you hear this, you're not alone, and you may feel at home at DinoCon, a convention specifically for lovers of pop culture dinosaurs. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry has more.
You may not realize just how long the history of dinosaurs is in popular culture. From the 1914 silent movie Gertie the Dinosaur up through King Kong and Godzilla to the Flintstones and Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Come play fetch with me.
Can't play fetch right now, Terry. I'm sick.
Please play fetch with me, please. Please, Pee-wee, please.
Rest assured, DinoCon will acknowledge them all. It's sort of like a Comic-Con to celebrate dinosaurs. There are exhibitors, panel discussions, and all the dino merchandise you can carry. The convention was started by two sisters, Patty Jimenez and Julia Zolons, who wasn't always a fan of the Jurassic-era creatures.
I was actually deathly afraid of dinosaurs until I was 30. And then I decided to take the plunge, and I watched all the Jurassic Parks in a row. And I discovered that I loved them, and I was obsessed with them.
So it makes sense that Jurassic Park features prominently in this convention. And one of the most anticipated guests of the day is Michael Trisic, a special effects artist responsible for the oh-so-terrifying T-Rex in the film. Trisic now lives in Sedona.
So he did everything from design it to make several scale models to the life-size animatronic and puppeteer the animatronic.
But it's not just the dinosaurs that will be celebrated. Co-founder Patty Jimenez says there will also be a hands-on space at DinoCon where fans can make their own miniature Teen Beat-style magazines that feature what she calls the hunks of Jurassic Park.
There is this glorious moment when Ian Malcolm, played by Jeff Goldblum, removes his shirt for no apparent reason. And he is our number one hunk.
And there's plenty of serious discussion on the schedule, too. Jimenez's 16-year-old son Trinidad will be leading one of the panels.
Last year, I did a panel on the differences and similarities between Jurassic Park, the movie, and the novel, which is one of my favorite novels. And so this year, to follow up, I decided to do essentially the same panel, but on Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World, both book and the movie.
Another highlight will be a geologist who will be talking about what pop culture gets right and wrong when it comes to dinosaurs. Patty Jimenez says it helps make DinoCon a great mix of fact and fiction.
It's the perfect combination of the pop culture that we're all about, but bringing in a little bit of the science of dinosaurs that people might be expecting.
In the end, it all comes back to the storybook dinos. And of course, Zolans and Jimenez each have their favorites. For Zolans, her childhood fears keep her favoring the sweeter of the prehistoric beasts.
I really like friendly dinosaurs. So I really like Rex from Toy Story. I think he's super sweet and a really good friend.
Do you know that as we calmly sit here, an intense debate rages within the paleontological community? Were dinosaurs hot-blooded or were they cold-blooded? I'm overwrought with anxiety over this issue. I mean, what temperature was their blood?
For Jimenez, it's classic. The Velociraptor from Jurassic Park.
I love that scene with Muldoon at the end, and the raptors have hunted him and distracted him, and then they come from the side, and he just looks up, and he's like, clever girl.
Clever girl.
And they just rawr, attack. It's just, she just like shivers down my spine. I love it.
Sarah Ventry, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
DinoCon will be tomorrow starting at 3 at the Phoenix Center for the Arts.
And just so you know, if you can't get enough of DinoCon, there's a DinoCon after party at Film Bar in Phoenix. It starts at 9. The real magic apparently happens at 11 with a one-night-only screening of the 90s classic, and I use air quotes with that, Adventures in Dinosaur City.
Mark, tonight at 8 at the Talking Stick Resort, Slash from Guns N' Roses will be there, so get your hi-hat on there and just crank out your guitar and welcome yourself to the jungle, my friend.
Absolutely. You can also hear Goo Goo Dolls and Daughtry at Comerica Theater in downtown Phoenix. That's Sunday night. Lots of music.
And the Queen of Mean on Saturday night will also be at the Talking Stick Resort. At 8 o'clock, Lisa Lampanelli. She's an insult comic. She first shocked fans on Comedy Central's Celebrity Roasts.
The show was produced this week by our senior producer, Triceratops Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond. I'm going to screw these all up. Drummondator, Nick Blumbinaptor, Nadine Arario Rodriguez. Do you want to try some of these?
Tiarosaurus Vian, Kendra Sabadactyl, Caitlin Steinodile,
and Astina Sigasaurus. I should have read these ahead of time. Tyrannosaurus Greer and Maria Dactyl Springs are our digital team.
Our managing predator is Al T-Mex Macias, and our executive carnivore, John Hobenapter.
For Steve Megalodonstein, I'm Mark Brodosaurus. I can actually do that one. This is Jurassic Era listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. It's 3 o'clock.